and welcome to The Schism. This podcast is all about critical thinking, dot connecting, the nature of reality, and trying to uncover the truth about the world we live in, society, who we are, and where we come from. Hello, and welcome to The Schism. I'm joined once again by my co-host, Adam.
Hello, everyone.
And in today's episode of The Schism, we will be speaking to Alexis Minkola, frontman of the industrial metal band Three Teeth, and old buddy, old pal of mine, Lex. Okay. Cheers for speaking to us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, boys. Great to be here. It's great to catch up. Haven't seen your face in ages, man. And yes, we do have a bit of a long storied history together.
Yeah, we knew each other before you started Three Teeth.
Before we both had bands, yeah. Long before that, actually. And sort of when the band was coming together, the sort of what I call like the primordial black ooze, which was a party called Little Death that ended up bringing all the bandmates together. And you know, I think was a really cool time actually in Los Angeles. I think in many ways it was like before we jumped into like the dark timeline of existence, like maybe we can earmark that with like when David Bowie died or something, where like things immediately just turned into like, I don't know, went right into the shitter. But I feel like that was a fun time in LA. It was a really cool party, and it brought some really cool like-minded people together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a big like clash of scenes because you had the whole like witch house scene.
It was really an interesting sort of like, yeah, the early witch house scene with like industrial techno and like obviously industrial rock, but like also just colliding with like the mean street of the fucking internet. You know what I mean? Like a lot of that culture was also forming in there, like, I don't know, we call it e-culture, whatever. But it was like a really cool time, and it brought together. It was still like, it was also like very much so before like Instagram. Do you know what I mean? Which, you know, people weren't glued to their phones. Obviously, it was still Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that. But I don't think people were like glued to their phones like they are now. So I think that like a party was actually people having a good time rather than like trying to capture and show that they're having a good time. You know what I mean? Like, and I think that was a real distinction that I remember like feeling, that it wasn't so much about being like, look where I am. It was more like people actually had their phones away and were having really good, fun sort of like time in these like little, almost like temporary autonomous zones of, I don't know, I guess like rave culture might've started a lot of that too. But
I mean, you had club photographers. That was a big thing that was going on because people weren't taking selfies and doing it themselves. It was like, oh, there's a club photographer. And it was always left to someone else.
They were capturing moments. Do you know what I mean? Like, obviously there was some pose, more stuff, but then there was a lot of really cool moments that were existing, and people would have to go like check a blog to like be like, oh, that was cool. Like, remember that? Oh, and stuff like that. But yeah, that was, it was interesting.
Well, you were doing this really cool green screen stuff because your background is obviously in design. Yeah. And you were building these really cool CGI green screens that we saw. We were working with a brand at the time, Boy, and I was like, I want you to make this dystopian Boy City. And then you made it, and then we actually met in person at the party, and I was like, oh, you're like the guy that done the backdrop.
That was the first time we met. Cool. I remember that. And we designed I designed this sort of like Neo Tokyo backdrop, and then like everyone, like,
you could even London.
The Boy London one. It was like a Boy London, Neo Tokyo, futuristic sort of like Blade Runner background. And then we started like weaving in props to it. Like, I remember like one of the photos I had the big handgun from Fifth Element, like the went over his arm, like that. Yeah, it was super fun, man. Like, that stuff was, it was like, at its time, it was really different and no one had done anything like that. So, you know, this idea of like people are just taking photos in front of a green screen, but like you could direct them, and then you could make things happen afterwards that they would be very unexpected. You know what I mean? Like, oh, like go like this. And then you could comp them on like a motorcycle riding through, and people would be like, what the hell is this? So it was a ton of work, but I think people really, really had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah. I kind of feel like you brought that same level of, I don't know what you would call it, theatrics or like, you know, with your band, like there's
I mean, it's called creativity for lack of a better term, but like, yeah, just trying to approach it from like doing stuff that was, you know, very much so like, again, my background was visual arts, and I think we're like heading into a time period where for better or worse, people were very much listening to music with their eyes. Do you know what I mean? Like it was very much like people wanted to see stuff that was different. And I think that for us, we were having a ton of fun with the visual content of Three Teeth initially in the beginning. The whole project itself started very much so like just very hobbyist. So it was just like, hey, we should just like make a fucking album because like that would be fun for us. But we had like no idea we'd end up like touring with Tool on our first record. Do you know what I mean? Like if I did, we probably would have taken a little bit more time on the record. I remember just like being in arenas like with Tool being like, man, like can't believe we just like wrote this shitty song in like an apartment and like now we're playing it in an arena. But yeah, it was very much so. It was like early memetics too. Like we're making a lot of sort of like almost like counter propaganda sort of like meme culture jamming stuff in the beginning. And I think that that caught a lot of attention. And it's like very different now. I think everything is like we live in almost like a post-memetic world where we're so inundated with it now that like I don't think it would cut through in the way that it did at the time. But at the time, I think like making stuff like that sort of counter propaganda meme culture in the beginning, I think really helped launch the band. You know what I mean? It put new eyes on it, put a lot of eyes on it. The internet is very much so like visually driven before it's auditorily driven. So you have to like lure people in with like something and how it looks. And then people like want to like click through enough to like end up listening to it. So
What was like lyric wise? Because I feel like you had something to say as well. Like, what, how much of a driving force was that for you, even forming the band in the first place? Or is that something that come after?
I mean, no, I mean, for me, I've always just like I studied political science in college. I've always, had quite a bit to say on the sort of anti-systemic front. And for me, like industrial music at its core was the thing that made it industrial was like the way it sort of like sucked poison out of industrial society and spit it back in its face. Do you know what I mean? Like that's what I liked about it. That's what made it heavy to me. Like I like metal across the board, but like a lot of metal is just like heavy riffs, blast beats, some guy just like screaming out like formlessness, death, and obliteration. Like there's not that much to that. You know what I mean? It's fun. And like maybe you get someone like writing a song about like some like Lovecraftian horror or something like that. Like that's cool, whatever. But for me, like I really like anchoring it in like something that was socio-political. And I think this was also before the world was so hyper-political. Like I think along the way, the world became like, when you have like 14-year-olds on TikTok talking about politics, you're like, I think we failed as a society. Do you know what I mean? Like that kid should be out having fun. But like I think that we were very much so this is Obama era. Do you know what I mean? This was like, hey, everything's fine, everything's good, everything's grand. But like as a person, I was like me constantly digging a little deeper was like, yeah, this is fucked. This is still equally as fucked. Do you know what I mean? And critiquing the sort of like the new neoliberal war machine, where it's like, I don't think my country has a left by any means. I think there's corporate center and corporate right, and like corporate center masquerades under the sort of like facade of, progressivism, which it isn't. So for me, like I was still a scathing critic of that stuff and a scathing critic of a lot of things that, under, for lack of a better term, like we could call like late stage capitalism now. And I think that, I like to make it clear I'm not some like sort of fucking, Marxist in the process too. Like I'm hyper aware of the sort of failures in that, but more of like a, we'll call myself like a, from an anarcho-autism standpoint, I think that's where I stand. But like, I think that for me, like the lyrics were everything to me, like to sort of get out my message, to sort of like just do it for myself even too. Like I wasn't like writing lyrics or anything else. It was just like I wanted to fucking, get my internal shit out, and how I felt about things. And I think it's sometimes easier to write stuff in a song than it is to try and explain to people. So yeah, I think that for some reason, like that stuff really hit at the time, which was cool. It was all very unexpected too. It was very much so like, wow, other people listen to our music. That's crazy.
I remember like not hearing or seeing from you for a while after your time at Little Death ended, and then suddenly you came back. It was like you were like re resurrected, and then, oh, I'm doing
And
three.
I did. I disappeared completely. Like I got rid of like I really, really went underground for a little bit, didn't communicate with people. And like I'm not the type of person that's like gonna sit there and be like, hey, by the way, I'm making a band. It's like I will go away and like write the album and then come back with it. I don't like, I think especially in a town like Los Angeles where It's filled with people like having like late night cocaine conversation about what they should do and what they're gonna do and then never doing it is like, to me, that's not something that I would ever want to associate with. So for me, like, I like to consider myself a little bit more of like a person of action and follow through and execution. And I do think people of execution are very rare across the board. Like, people can actually like follow through on an idea. So I like kind of pride myself on that. So for me, it was very much so like, until I'm holding a vinyl, it's like I always say this, like, it's not final till it's on vinyl, like until I have my fucking
Oh,
record.
it's not final until it's on vinyl.
And he can
Yeah.
fit in his hand.
Yeah, I stole that from my older brother, and that's one of those things that was kind of like you gotta fucking have a vinyl record. And to me, like, that physical form of media like gives it a little bit more value. Cause we do, like, everything was like digital on SoundCloud, but like to me, like, that's just so there's so much throwaway shit on there. But if once you have a record, it's like you've committed to like bringing something into reality, which I thought was cool.
They're annoying to get rid of vinyls. Like I have a lot of them at my place. It's like it doesn't feel right chucking a vinyl record into a dustbin or something. You just keep them
No,
around.
it becomes very permanent in that respect, you know. And then yeah, I think that's the right word. It's like digital music always kind of feels like slightly disposable. Like you could just be like delete, but like vinyl is very hard to dispose of, you know.
Yeah, like even in a physical sense, it's a big thing. It's quite well crafted. Even if it's a shit vinyl, you're like, I'll give it to a charity shop.
Yeah, for sure. Ends up in like a $1 bin somewhere, you know
I have about 6,000 vinyls at my house. Not in the room we're in at the moment, but the other room, like at one stage, you couldn't even really
I was gonna
navigate.
say that almost gives me anxiety to the point where like you can't really move. You know what I mean?
It's
Like,
horrible. Yeah, it's like a massive anchor weighing you down. Not recommended.
I feel that way about books sometimes too, where it's like
Oh,
anytime
yeah,
I
books are
move.
the same.
Yeah, books are very, very challenging to like, you know, once you have an insane collection, it's like it anchors you in where you are. Cause like the idea of moving all those books, you end up either giving a ton away, which is fine. But you know, this idea of like if you do have nice books, it's like the heaviest thing to move with too. Do you know?
Well, talking of books, I mean, it's a bit left field this, but I remember from way back, you either telling me or me hearing about your father, who's an author that's written books
Yeah.
about, is it alternative medicine?
Yeah, he's a holistic doctor, and you know, he's got his like PhDs in psychology and nutrition, and he's a heady dude, and he's very much so like, you know, was on the forefront of what he called like, I guess, complementary medicine, where you're sort of like, you're not like, oh, like you're not discarding Western medicine, but like the idea that like take Eastern philosophy, combine it with Western technology, and then you're sort of creating a position of like, you know, understanding how these two can really complement each other. Where, you know, I think that Western medicine, where it fails philosophically, is that it's oftentimes like crucially incentivized from a profit position. Do you know what I mean? It's like for-profit medicine is just a bad idea. And I think that ultimately, you know, the idea of healing is very different from the idea of doctoring. And I think that doctoring is more akin to like going to a mechanic or something like that. You know what I mean? Like you're gonna go in there and they're gonna go, oh yeah, but you gotta replace your air filter too, and you gotta do this. And oh, we should have rotated your tire. Next thing you're like, why am I getting like hit with all these bills? I just came in to get my oil changed. But there's very much a like opportunistic energy there where it's like,
Yes,
how do
the
we
same
capitalize?
kind of business model.
Yeah, exactly. How do we capitalize on it? You know what I mean? And it's like it's the business of sick. So like the idea of like making everyone healthy is sort of very counterintuitive to their business model. And again, like I actually don't think that, like I'm not saying like doctors are bad people. I think, you know, people get into wanting to heal people and to help people is a very honorable and sort of admirable position to be. But I do think that the system itself is fairly flawed. In terms of how we treat medicine and how we treat people. And I think that eventually the system itself will sort of perverse or corrupt what the intention of the persons are. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't matter how good your intentions are when the system itself is going to, and I don't even mean like corrupt you as in like make you like diabolical, but corrupt in terms of how you're allowed to operate. Like the ecosystem itself is bad. But yes,
So
it's
how, I mean, that straight away just makes me think of the whole COVID era, because the last time I saw you was before all that kicked off. And
strange thing that like we never really even had any closure on it. Do you know what I mean? Like we just moved right on to the war in Ukraine. It was just like we just had a rebound crisis. Do you know what I mean? We didn't get to like sit down and talk about our relationship with COVID and why it's ending and what happened, what it was about. We just like we just got dumped and we just like moved right on to fucking the next rebound, which
Crisis.
we never processed it. And I think that like it's the type of thing that like in 20 years, sunlight is the greatest disinfectant. The idea that there will be things that will come to light that I think that people will discuss. And, again, without even like getting into the minutia of it, I think that like, okay, let's talk about the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry is like maybe a shower cleaner than the mafia. Do you know what I mean? Like maybe one shower at best. Like they make zillions of dollars, and whenever you put zillions of dollars into something, it's just like it's going to essentially fuck it up. So I'm not saying that like pharmaceutical medicine is inherently bad, but the pharmaceutical industry has been sued a zillion times over. They've created opioid epidemics. They have essentially made, their fortunes and their off the backs of putting people in really fucked up positions. And I think that just to look at them as an industry and say like, okay, when did we just decide to these guys are the good guys? Do you know what I mean? Like it's never been the case. They don't operate from a position of beneficence. Like, oh, we got to do this to save people. They go, what are fourth quarter fucking profits and how do we make more money than God? That's what they do. And I think that like when you sort of look at that and you give it the sort of like who benefits, the qui bono, and like, that crisis in general made them more fucking money than ever. And it was funny too, because it was like, I'm not going to put on my tinfoil hat too much here, but it was like right at the same time that like fentanyl sort of started to exist, where fentanyl, being a cheap synthetic opioid from China, essentially no longer lets us, like, you can't make the money that you could off opiates anymore, where it's like we ended up pulling out of Afghanistan as a result of this, because we're like, we don't really have any interest in controlling the opiate fields anymore, which I always thought that no one even talked about that. But like when we tuck tail in Afghanistan and say, hey, let's get the fuck out of here. We don't need to be here anymore. And it's like, oh, wait, because they're shifting their profit center away from opiates to vaccines. That's what they made their money off of, fucking opiates. And now they're going to make it off vaccines. And again, I'm not saying that like they caused the fucking thing. I'm not saying that, they were behind any of this. But what I am saying is they made a lot of fucking money. And I know that as a band who went on tour, and there was a lot of people who were vaccinated, some people weren't vaccinated on that tour, and it didn't make a fucking difference. It made no difference. Everyone still got COVID, and it wasn't someone got it worse or better. And again, like I'm not saying that the vaccine didn't do any good, but I certainly think that it needed to be questioned a bit more. And I think the hysteria surrounding it regarding people being like, if you're not vaccinated, you're gonna kill my fucking grandmother. And like, if you're not vaccinated, you need to be sentenced to death. Like the hysteria that surrounded it was insane. You know what I mean? I think like everyone needs to sort of forgive each other and forgive themselves for like how hysterical COVID made us all. And I think back on that, and to watch the sort of like hypocrisy that existed around like the same people who would beat their drums about like, Roe v. Wade and pro-choice, like my body, my choice, were the same people that were also out in the streets being like, you need to get fucking vaccinated or you're gonna blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, where do we draw the line there? There needs to at least be a consistency. And I get it, they're different things, but I think that like forcing someone into any sort of medical operation is insane. So I don't know. I think that, obviously COVID is a huge can of worms and everyone has, their thoughts and their opinions on it, but
What was it like being in LA during COVID?
you just hear it. I went to the desert and had the fucking best time. It was like one of the best fucking, it was crazy. Like everything about it was so much fun. And I had like survivor's guilt from it because I was enjoying it so much. Cause like we were just in the desert working on a record and pretty much sort of very oblivious to like,
But that was a conscious choice, right? Like you wanted to get out of the city, like let's get the hell out of here, let's go to the desert.
Yeah, and I think that in general, I think that COVID did one thing in particular to people that we can all agree on, is it made people realize the further you are from the power structures, the more likely you are just to just die in like a shitty way. Do you know what I mean? So it's like the idea that like COVID isn't that bad if you live in like a fucking 20-acre mansion with a swimming pool and a basketball court. Do you know what I mean? But if like you're living in like a fucking two-bedroom apartment with like your three. and like your wife and like a shitty part of town, like, and you can't leave, like COVID is really, really bad for you because like that stress that's going to put on your life and your relationship and, you know, your kids and like your inability to go to the office and that space that you needed, like that stuff was really fucking tough on people. And it really fucking brought people to the brink of their sanity. So, you know, the idea that like shut in orders and shutting down this world was the best idea, I'm not sure. And I don't, my hunch is maybe it wasn't. But ultimately I think that the experience that the world had was vastly different based on social strata. And you know, the idea that, you know, the richest people in the world got like insanely richer as a result of this, it just felt weird. It just felt fishy. So ultimately, I think COVID will be one of those things that in years to come that more people will talk about. And they already are. And there's already new things coming to light, but it's funny because it doesn't seem like it makes the headline. It doesn't seem like it's
No.
that important to anyone anymore. Why? Because we have that fucking goldfish brain where we like, you know, everyone's so busy with their own fucking shit that like we like just forget that we even did that. You know what I mean? We're just like, oh yeah, like life's back to normal, whatever, next fucking thing, who cares? Too busy worried about how I'm going to cover my rent this month, or like the fact that it's been like, you know, can I even deal with another $200 grocery trip? Do you know what I mean? Like the world's so squeezed right now that I think that like it's too hard to even go back to like waste the energy to think about that or point fingers at it or try and like do some sort of like existential detective work on like what the fuck it was, because it just doesn't even matter. We're too busy dealing with the next thing in front of us right now. And I think that like I think that happens too with like the amount of money that was dumped into the government or into the economy during COVID created a hyperinflation after the fact. And that hyperinflation makes things extremely expensive, which creates a sense of scarcity of like goods where you're just like, man, everything's expensive. I can't afford this. I can't afford that. What do we do? And I think that that squeezes the world in a particular way that it puts us against each other, where it's just like, you know, little things where it's like when everyone's getting squeezed, they start to squeeze each other. Do you know what I mean? The bottom starts to squeeze each other with like, oh, like, well, you know, like I can't pay you this anymore. And they're like, well, fuck you. And then I'm like, they squeeze the other person. And the shit just rolls downhill where it's like everyone ends up having this sense of distrust, a sense of division, a sort of atomization of each other, this inability of collectively to sort of support each other. So that scarcity of inflation creates more division of individuals that prevent us from even being able to form a collective enough to go, hey, what the fuck was COVID? You know what I mean? So I think something interesting there, where again, we just aren't even paying attention to that because we're too busy just trying to fucking survive and keep the lights on and keep our head above water, you know?
Yeah, like it almost feels like it didn't happen. Like we have an episode called Fever Dream that
Yeah.
we just had to record because it got to a certain point, and us two were going, no one's even talking about the last few years. Like no one's taking a step back and going, what the fuck was that all about? We were wearing masks, we were standing 6 feet apart, we were doing all this crazy stuff. And it, rather than kind of addressing it, it just completely went by. But we had the kind of opposite effect where we couldn't get away. So we were right in the city for it in London. And we were joining all the protests. We decided to set up the podcast. We got like really involved in it all because it was getting so ridiculous. Like around where I lived, you couldn't go into places without showing a QR code. You had to wear a mask everywhere. There was people queuing up outside supermarkets. Britain's, I mean, you've been here enough times on tour and stuff, can be pretty glum, like with the weather, the general look of the place.
The
People were
people.
just like there, hunched over with masks in the rain around the block. Because they can only go in 6 feet apart at a time. It was so Orwellian. It was so dystopian. Like, but us living amongst this.
And the problem with a moment like COVID too is like, you know, laws that get passed, institutions that created and funded to exist during a state of emergency, those things don't disappear. Do you know what I mean? Like governments don't like to give rights back. Institutions that exist, and I'm not saying that like they're doing it from like a malicious mindset, but rather like, okay, we've formed a new institution. We've hired, you know, X amount of hundreds of people. We funded them with this thing in the government. That thing will self-preserve. It wants self-preservation is its baseline mode, where it's like that's the factory setting where it wants to keep its funding. It wants to keep the people that are employed there. So when those institutions are formed, those institutions don't disappear. They have an incentive. They're incentivized to keep it going as long as possible because that's what they exist for. So it doesn't want to disappear. So it's like those little things that get set in motion, those little laws and institutions, they end up lingering for much longer than they need to if they even disappear at all. And I think that that stuff is it's detrimental to how much longer it needed to go on. Do you know what I mean? The narrative gets shifted by them because they're the institutions that are in control to do that, and they're sort of like, approving their own funding.
Well, David Icke calls it the totalitarian tiptoe.
Fear.
What's that interesting, right? So obviously, my band Creepin' toured with you guys just before COVID. Can't remember the year exactly, but it was like a year or two before COVID, 2018. And then COVID hit, and it was like, oh my God, you guys obviously went off to the desert to do your thing. I was in a two-piece, and my bandmate, Sebastian, he just went MIA, yet to resurface. He just disappeared off the face of the earth. He went off social media. He's never gone back on. No one can reach him on a phone. He's just, I don't know where. If you're listening, Sebastian, get in touch. But yeah, he's off grid. Like I don't know what happened to him, but it kind of felt like it sucked him under in a way. And I was left kind of like, oh damn. So I kind of had to finish the record by myself with the help of engineer that I met back here that helped me finish it and even played some parts on it. And then now I'm kind of just carrying it on with some other people because I just never heard from this person again.
It kicked the knees out on so many things with that, had so much momentum. And I think that's the stuff that, even for my band, like, dude, we were touring in 2020 of February, all the way to the end of February, where COVID broke out. Like, literally, like, we were in Europe for 30 dates. Like, the Milan date was canceled because of COVID. And I was like, oh, that sucks for Italy. I thought it was just like, didn't even consider it. And then I remember they canceled the NBA season. I was like, oh, that's the canary in the coal mine. Something really bad is happening. We're not as big as the NBA. And, they're canceling an NBA season. So I think that, like, for as long as COVID lasted, my band lost so much momentum to the point where, like, I don't even know, do I even want to do it anymore? Like, we felt like a rocket ship on that tour. I remember, like, London smash crowd at Heaven. It was just like, man, I remember being like, this band's here to stay. Everything we did, it's paid off. 10 years of work, let's go. Then, like, within like the 2 to 3 years of what happens, like, dude, the adrenaline leaves your body. The delusion that you even have to be in a band becomes something that you just end up sort of being like, damn, like it disappears, and you start, like, reality comes into place about, like, oh wait, like, am I going to even be able to buy a home like this forever? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, all that sort of that momentum that kept you on that sort of path of that pipe dream even starts to fade, in the sense of like, wait, no, I have to be a little bit more pragmatic. Like, this is like could happen any time in the world again. And I think it forced a lot of people to have those sort of deeper, I guess, self internal audits that I think that was really tough on artists, especially. Do you know what I mean? Like, okay, cool. Like, am I gonna like go become a fucking real estate agent now? Do you know what I mean? Like, I think people went from like, being that artist to being like, no, I gotta figure something else out. Because, I know people from all walks of, stage life where it was like, you can't work from home if you're a fucking comedian. You know what I mean? Like, you need audience, you need that. And then everything shifted online because of it. So next thing you know, everyone's just like super hyper focused on doing things like this on Zoom. Do you know what I mean? All work was just this. Oh, and then it was like, oh, it's all about posting online, and everything just shifted into this huge digital world. You know what I mean? Not that it wasn't already there, but it really sort of became like, people were like making pushes towards the metaverse. Like, hey, the shittier it gets outside, the deeper we're gonna go into an online fucking universe. And like, if that's not dystopian, I don't know what the fuck is. Do you know what I mean? Like, so dystopian. So, I think that COVID had deep psychological effects on people that are still lasting and still revealing themselves. That as much as we don't like to look back at like the overall moment, I think we're all still looking back on what it did to us. For example, like, where the fuck is Sebastian? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, that's a crazy thing that probably wouldn't have happened without COVID. Do you know what I mean?
No,
Like,
it was the last, like, nail in the coffin for sure. Like it just Yeah, kind of like stopped everything dead in its tracks. We were even signed to a label. The label went under. So it's like, okay, so we don't have that anymore. And then after a certain amount of waiting, just for closure, I thought I've got to finish the record. But now I've kind of carried it on, released a few bits, going to put out another album just as a, different kind of outfit, because I didn't just want to stop the project because one member couldn't stand the storm.
The show must go on, and it's definitely sad because he was a fucking cool dude and wildly talented and super weird and fun and
He's definitely super weird.
yeah,
He's
definitely super weird. Love the
weird.
guy, one of the weirdest guys I've ever met. But it is funny how this idea of going out there and being in a van with your band and fucking touring and like that sort of foundation of starting a band has really disappeared since COVID. Now it's about like I'm just gonna start my thing on TikTok, get my followership up as much as possible, and then get a label, and then I'll start playing live shows. But like before, it was like, dude, you got in a van, traveled around the country with your buddies, and like really like road dogged it and like roughed it up and like played in front of small audiences, and like that was foundational to like creating a band. And now it's just so manufactured online, going back to this idea that everything shifted to online, where like now it's the only game in town. Like, I don't even think that like you can make a popular project without it being a TikTok centric thing right now. You know what I mean? Like,
You're right.
and that's sort of where I go, dude, I didn't get into this to do that. I just didn't. You know what I mean? So like when the label's like, constantly nagging me to like make TikTok. Make TikToks, make TikToks. Like to me, I go, nah, I just then I don't want to do it anymore. Funny story, I did start making TikToks, but it was just me blowing stuff up in the desert with guns and explosives. And they were like, all right, stop making TikToks. I feel like one of the things that I sort of did during COVID was I really kind of came out of my gun closet where like, I have a big penchant for firearms, and what we have in this country is the Second Amendment. And to me, it's sort of in a place like Los Angeles, it's controversial, which it shouldn't be. It's your fucking right in this country. It shouldn't be controversial. It's the Second Amendment right, and you should be able to exercise it without people sort of waving a heavy finger at you. But I lost a lot of followers in that process. Gained a whole new series of followers, which is great. And then, it all evened out. And, I definitely got a lot of crap from my management, and the label was very confused by it. But eventually they just kind of put up with it and said, okay, after time, they just got, that's what he is now. But for me, I have been a big proponent of the Second Amendment in this country. And, I think that it's something that in our country, at least, it's the Second Amendment gives teeth to all the other amendments. That's what it's there for. You know what I mean? It's there to make sure the First Amendment can't go away. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. And people think that like, whoa, but like, the founding fathers didn't intend on, having AR-15s or M4s or, semi-automatic military style rifles,
Yeah, but the founding fathers also didn't have F-16 jets and nuclear bombs.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily about the style of weapon or the technology, it was about parity of power. So, if this is what the military has, and this is what the civilian should have, and this is what the police have, this is what the civilian should have, and it should be your right to defend yourself. It should be a lot of things that it just doesn't have to do with the fact that, like, oh, like you're supposed to have a single shot fucking, lever action or something. It's like it doesn't matter. That's not the point. It's about parity of power. And listen, if the police and the military didn't have it, then they'd be fine. You shouldn't have it either. But the reality is they do, and the genie's out of the bottle, and you should be able to own whatever firearm you want to own.
So what did you think when you heard Biden say that line where he was like, well, if you want to protect yourself from the government, you're going to need an F-16, as in a fighter jet?
I mean, tell that to Afghanistan. You know what I mean? Like, what do they have? Like, didn't they run us out of there eventually? I think we tucked tail and left there and left all our weapons, but I think all they had was AK-47. So, ultimately, I don't think this is even about fighting the government per se, but 1/3 of all firearms in the globe are owned by the US civilian population. So yeah, that would be a tough battle to fight if there ever was a sort of united sort of civilian population in this country. I think it would be the largest fighting force in the world.
Yeah, well, we kind of touched on this about the American people being very different to the British people and populace over in Europe, because you are an armed populace between you and a tyrannical government. I mean, we were looking across the pond and thinking, well, at least you guys got a fair battle on your
Yeah,
hands.
almost feels like if America fell and you guys gave up your right to arms, the rest of the world would be, or the rest of the Western world would be at risk. I mean, that's how it feels to
Yeah, I think it would
me.
be it's impossible. Like when I say impossible, I can't stress that enough. It would be impossible to disarm the US population.
Oh, yeah.
Genie is out of the bottle. No one's knocking door to door to be like, give me your guns. You know what I mean? Like, that's a tough, you know what I mean? No one's doing that to be like, people are armed to the fucking teeth in this country for better or worse. But the reality is, it just is what it is. You don't get to put that genie back in the bottle, it's out. And this is a country that was founded on firearms. This is a country that, in the battle of like, in Concord, Massachusetts, that like, a bunch of teenagers with rifles said, hey, we don't want to, pay taxation without representation to, these redcoats, and fired back at them. And the shot heard around the world was like what essentially is like the catalyst for the creation of the United States. So this is a country that's history is founded in firearms. I also think, furthermore, like if you really want to explore the human relationship with firearms, it's, let's go back hundreds and hundreds of years ago where like they had swords. You know what I mean? Like it's no different. That's just what they had. And they didn't let poor people work with swords. You know what I mean? Like they just didn't. It was something that, like, oh, you're wealthy, you get to train with your sword. So at the end of the day, like it's your duty to know how to use a sword if you have the option to use a sword, and then you can defend yourself. A gun is the same thing then. It's just like, hopefully you never have to use a gun, but you should know how to use a gun. It's a tool. It's like driving a fucking stick shift. Like you probably don't know how to need to know how to drive a stick shift in the United States, but what if one day that's the only car you have to drive and you have to drive a manual and you can't? That sucks. Same day that everyone in the Ukraine learned how to use guns pretty fucking quick when they were getting invaded. And I always thought how scary that would have to be to be like, oh my God, now I'm gonna have to learn how to do this because I have no other option. So for me, I think that it's always good to have the capacity to be dangerous. You know what I mean? Like if you need to.
And what would you say to someone that was like, oh, just because the classic sort of argument is, oh, just ban assault rifles or just ban, what's the gun we were chatting about? It's always been there.
Lex mentioned it, the old AR-15, the one they love to bring up.
In all the school shootings, right? So they kind of want to like zone into them first, saying, look, we just want to ban this.
The AR-15 is just a phenomenally designed rifle. And, at the end of the day, semi-automatic, or first of all, people say assault rifles. Assault rifle is a very confused term because assault rifle means it's full auto or has select fire. You can't buy a full auto rifle in the United States as a civilian. Those are reserved for the military. Those are reserved for, a certain class of even firearms manufacturer or dealer can have those. But as an average civilian, you can't have that. So an assault rifle is not really what it is. What it is a AR-15 pattern rifle, which is a modular weapon. At the end of the day, it's a box-fed or magazine-fed rifle that every time you pull the trigger once, it sends a round down the range. It doesn't matter if you do it with a pistol or a rifle, or the particular rifle. It doesn't matter if it's an AR-10, doesn't matter if it's an AK-47 or an AK-74. There's so many different types of guns that do the same killing. It's just that this is a very common rifle and a very well, it's a very reliable. So does being reliable make it more deadly? Absolutely, because every time you pull it, it goes bang. It doesn't go click. Oh, there's something wrong with it. It doesn't malfunction. Does it make it evil? No, it just makes it a well-designed tool. But you take an AR-15 out of the, oh, you can't buy those anymore. Does it prevent an angry kid who is probably pumped up on SSRIs and suicidal ideation and, no access to mental health benefits or anything like that? Like, does that prevent him from wanting to go do murder? I don't think so. I think
Not
figure out another way to do it, all it does is penalize the law-abiding citizen from going out and buying it and being able to defend themselves. Because as a person who owns a lot of AR-15s, it's a phenomenal rifle. It's a working rifle. It's a rifle that, you would grab to do any myriad of things. So I think it gets a bad rap, and it's an easy thing to point a finger at because it's what's used the most. That's like also being like, the most car accidents that happen are in Honda Civics. It's like there's a lot of Honda Civics or something. And it doesn't make the Honda Civic a bad car.
So what's your like, because you obviously done the cover of Pumped Up Kicks, which is I mean, I'm not sure if it's about a school shooter, but it kind of
Absolutely.
says that kind of thing. But what's your opinion on whether it's school shootings or this like outrageous Vegas shooting or whatever? Like, do you think that, the conspiracy theorist within both of us on the schism kind of goes straight away to, well, these were setups, these were patsies that were put in place to create these crises to try and disarm the American population, or we take the assault rifles off them first and then
Or
move on to something
if
else.
not necessarily those events, it looks more and more like a common theme that that's what the American government are trying to do to the American people through which way
Yeah,
or another.
I think there's certainly an agenda on the left to disarm people from military-style weapons or prevent them from being sold any further. But even if they did do that tomorrow, like I said, it wouldn't make any difference because there's still so it's so easy to manufacture firearms. It's so easy. Like a firearm is a very rudimentary thing. It's a fucking pipe with a fucking exploding projectile in it. Do you know what I mean? In terms of like 3D printing parts, in terms of creating firearms, it's always going to be something that human beings can do. In terms of the amount of ones that are already out there on the streets, the ones that are already out there in people's homes, there's so many. So if you go, hey, you can't buy AR-15s tomorrow, what does that even accomplish? Do you know what I mean? Bad guys are still going to manufacture them because they don't care. That no one goes out and buys like, a fucking Gucci 1911 to rob a bank. They just always have a shitty gun that just like gets the job done. So it's like you could 3D print a really shitty high point pistol and rob a 7-Eleven or do an armed robbery anywhere. So it's like I don't think you stop criminals by banning stuff. I think all you do is prevent law-abiding citizens who want to defend themselves. In terms of, getting back to the school shooter topic, I think that's a really challenging topic to discuss. I don't have any real take on whether or not some of these are like, I don't even know what you'd call like a false flag or like a millet like a government psyop fucking bullshit. But like for the most part, I probably don't think that's what it is. Maybe like, I don't know. The Vegas shooter one, I have no idea. That's so fucking weird. And we've never taught and people don't talk about that anymore. But I think your average kid who's pumped up on fucking SSRIs, and if you read the fucking panel of side effects on those things and how like doctors prescribe those things willy-nilly in this fucking country, it's like suicidal ideation is like, it's pretty fucking standard. And if you know anyone who's been on those and you talk to them how it made them feel and stuff like that, and it's like, I think that people are so fucking pumped up on bad and weird medication that, like, what might feel as like a heavy moment in high school, even for a kid who's not pumped up on medication, it does feel like life or death sometimes. It did feel like, your world is collapsing around you. And without a support system of a loving family, without access to mental health stuff, I think it's a bigger issue than the firearm. People don't need a firearm to do harm to this world. Do you know what I mean? When you're angry enough. And I think that, at the end of the day, there's a lot of disenfranchised, broken people out there that, get so upset they want to see the world burn. How do you prevent that? It's a holistic prevention. It's not legislative solutions for spiritual problems is a quagmire that I think a lot of people would, if you really try and unravel it, you kind of go, oh yeah, can you even legislate against that? No, there's a problem in this country that is much greater than the firearm itself. The firearm is just a tool that ends up being used. And I don't think that, again, being able to legislate out of it changes anything. But if you really look at the numbers of school shootings, if you really look at the numbers of gun violence and gun-related murder in this country, which most people don't, it's funny. It's roughly around the same as car accident deaths, which is like anywhere from like, 38 to 40,000 people a year die of gun-related violence in this country, as they do in vehicles. That being said, if you look how you break down on a pie chart of what gun-related death looks like in this country, 60% of it is suicide. 60%. Another massive chunk of it is like police shootings. You know what I mean? Another massive chunk of it is just,
accidentals.
yeah, accidentals. When you look at the percentage of that that actually makes up for school shootings, and granted, any percent of it should not be school shootings. You know what I mean? Like, no percent of it should be school shootings, but it's like less than 1%. So it's like, yes, is less than 1% still too much? 100%. But when people start to look at that greater number as like, oh my God, do you know how many people die in this country of fucking gun-related violence? And you're like, all right, why don't you focus on the 60%, which is suicide? Which, if someone wants to kill themselves, I don't think the gun is the thing that's making them kill themselves. They're going to figure out a way to kill themselves, whether it's through be overdosing or jumping off a fucking bridge. If anything, they're just making a quicker out with the gun. But I think that these numbers aren't explored in any meaningful or intellectual way. I think that they're used for be politicized and create hysteria. And I think it's just simply not the case. I think, moreover, the Second Amendment and our Bill of Rights in this country is in many ways a magical spell against tyranny. And if you move any one of those, the butterfly effect will have profound consequences. If you were to pull the Second Amendment out of that thing, this country no longer ceases to be, it ceases to be what it is. And I think that it's easy to be outside looking in and just go, guns are bad. Like, we don't need them. Guns are bad. But that is a very naive perspective to have. And, you know, I think that it's something that I've become increasingly more passionate about the more I've learned about it, the more I've learned about what the 2A community is and what it stands for in this country. And yeah, sure, of course, you're going to get a spectrum of it. You're going to get some more extreme people, but then also you're going to get some very sensible gun owners in this country that, you know, live in rural places that, you know, the cops aren't coming there. You know what I mean? Like, when I lived out in the desert for as long as I can, for as long as I did, people aren't coming to help you. You know what I mean? This idea that, oh, something went wrong, or you're camping out by yourself and you know, 50 miles from anything. It's like you need to be your own defense department. You know what I mean? You need to have a sense of self-reliance. You need to have that sidearm on you to prevent the nightmare that could happen, whether it's a mountain lion or whether it's some fucking methed up tweaker that wants to steal your truck. Do you know what I mean? It's like the idea that somehow, you know, the police are going to be there to help you, or the government is there to help you. It's like, it's a delusion, you know? And I think self-reliance is the best perspective to have with firearms, to be like, hey, you use it to be self-reliant.
Do you feel like you're fully doomsday prepped? Because I remember when I first started seeing the stuff of you, like firstly out in the desert, which I didn't know was connected to you doing an album. So as an onlooker, I was like, he's out in the desert. Then you were like, had all these firearms. I was like, is Lex literally getting ready for like civil war
Oh, I mean,
or Armageddon
it's funny.
or?
Like, I just also like, for me, like I like competition shoot and like stuff like that. Like, for me, like, I just like it from a precision sporting. I build rifles. I like to sort of tune them and long distance shoot. And you know, I just, for me, it's as much sport as it is like a sense of potential readiness of like, you know, I've got enough firearms to like, you know, arm the neighborhood. Do you know what I mean? Not that I think it will ever come to that, or that it needs to come to that. But for me, I like firearms. I think there's a strange sense of catharsis and a little bit of a therapy that comes out of it. And I know people are go, oh, that guy sounds like a gun nut. But you know, if you ever had a chance to shoot a gun, like, you're
No.
not about anything else but shooting the gun. It
That's
puts you in a
true.
very much so main, like, because it is a dangerous thing. And I'm sure you get the same thing from riding a motorcycle or mountain climbing. You're not like, did I send that email earlier? No, you're in that moment. You're focused and, like, you know, running drills, and it feels like it's like everything else melts away. So for me, I really like that aspect of it, and I think that's super nice. But yes, in terms of, you know, being a doomsday prepper, no, but I am very prepared. You know what I mean? Like, from like my truck that, you know, is very capable of doing, you know, a lot of off-roading, and I haul extra fuel, and I have 8 gallons of water on it, and I have a camper tent on it. Like, I like being able to go live off-grid for a week and unplug, sort of have my little version of, like, it's pretty still luxury. I got like satellite internet, and I can like work out there, and like, you know, I set up a little
Right.
base myself, but it's awesome. I just love it. For me, it's not like I'm like drilling for like bug out, but for me, it's a way to like actually unplug from fucking everything and just get a little off grid and come back to it and go, oh, I feel a little better, you know.
So when you were out in the desert and you were recording the album, what sort of themes were going into you writing the record, and did you get straight down to business or?
We fucked off for a few months, and I kind of put together like a concept guide and was like really writing more so like song ideas. And like I made like a whole map. Like I made like a whole document. Like, you know me, like I gotta art direct everything. And I made this whole like almost document of ascension where it starts like under the earth and it goes and it like leaves the planet. And you know, I kept thinking about like when you're out there in the desert, you kind of feel like you're like a marble hurling through space, and you do get a sense of how small we are as a planet, and all the fucking earthly bullshit that we deal with sometimes feels like it sort of melts away. So I was like very much so in like a little bit more of a cosmic headspace out there, and you know, I kept having these sort of like weird ideas of like feeling like we're already off world, because it does, you feel like you're in the sort of Martian landscape while you're out there. And it's an amazing feeling, and I really like it. But it was back when like also like Jeff Bezos would be like, I'm taking a rocket to like suborbital space, and like all these billionaires are like, we're gonna go live on Mars. And you kept thinking to yourself, like the irony of like, you know, eventually all billionaires just become refugees and like everyone else dies. And like, I don't know, just like we all just like the idea that they're gonna go live on fucking Mars, it seems so silly to me. And I just kept kind of like, I don't know. There's a lot of like tongue-in-cheek sort of stuff in here, like that song Alien, and like there's a lot of, I guess, celestial sort of tongue-in-cheek concept in that record that, you know, it was deeply inspired by the desert, and you know, some of it was a little bit more like heartfelt, you know, a song like Drift, where it was very much so like just felt like I was kind of drifting away from this, even this project, this whole fucking world. And it was definitely, it felt like a little bit of like a resignation to just like leave society and go live out in the desert, you know. It's weird, there's moments, because I stayed out in the desert for much longer than the album. I stayed out there for quite some time, and it's weird, it's like you really learn how to be alone in a nice way, where like there's a difference between like being alone and being lonely, and like you sort of like become like good company for yourself. And you know, it's sort of like my Thoreau, Walden Pond, you know, where he was like out there writing civil disobedience and like nature, and like I was just out in the desert blowing stuff up.
Well, you had before this album, you had the whole President X. So, for people that haven't seen it, you had this video where you were like a reptilian or reptilianoid president. You even carried this into the live shows and stuff. Firstly, what was that like wearing that mask and doing
It
that?
was atrocious to wear the mask. You know, RIP to Lanny Chantel, who designed the mask, and we did the music video together. She passed away from an overdose very sadly. And just a phenomenally talented makeup artist. And when I had the idea to do President X, it was during like, you know, this Trump administration where everyone was just like, Trump's the worst thing in the world, Trump's this. And I'm like, dude, all presidents are shit. Do you know what I mean? This idea that it wasn't about him. And I didn't want to like, and this is when the world became so intensely political that like even being political or anything was annoying. And like we were a band that were already doing like heavy sort of political social commentary. So I just wanted to make fun of the whole thing. And for me, President X was like a way to sort of let people put their version of like what president they dislike in there. And it was like kind of like a bit of a cognitive dissonance trap where I was kind of just like making fun of all of that. But it made people really fucking get weird. You know what I mean? Like it drew an energy out of people, which is interesting. Like it got accused of being anti-Semitic. It got accused of being pro this. And I was just like, dude, I'm in a lizard mask. You know what I mean? But people projected their hatred and anger onto it, which I just thought was really funny and sort of a bit of an experiment, where
Like, what must it be like?
supposed to be a good guy. We assassinate him at the end of the video. You know what I mean? Like, we weren't celebrating the lizard man. We were playing we were taking the piss out of it. You know what I mean? As for the record, I don't think reptilian people exist, but I do think reptilian energy, if you look at the brain stem, the ancient part of the brain, the amygdala, is considered the reptilian part of the brain. It's very ancient.
Yeah, the R
R
complex.
complex. Yeah, exactly. The R complex. So it's like, to me, you know, what is that based on? Like, you know, survival, sex, fight, flight, all these things that, like, you know, it's constantly like as an energy. I think that like we're constantly being forced into that. So like there's a reptilian energy is based on a brain physiology that, like, you know, these very selfish greedy people that are like, creating generational wealth because they want to preserve it for their families, their sense of survival. And like, then they also want to wage war because it's like, that's where that part of the brain, that primal part of that
Oh,
brain,
cold-blooded.
cold-blooded. And to me, like, that's the extent that I think that, like, and we all have that in us. And I think that it feeds off all of us too, where it's like, it pits us against itself. So to me, just to make it clear, I don't believe there's lizard people, but I do believe in like the reptilian energy that we have in ourselves. So to me, we're playing a lot off that shit. You know what I mean? So like, there's always more to meets the eye than even if we're just like, making fun of something. There's layers to it. You know what I mean?
So with the new album artwork, which I'm guessing is from you, you've got the intertwined snakes that are making up like a DNA helix. Like, what was the thinking in that? Because straight away we were thinking of like the pandemic and
Yeah, I mean, it was supposed to conjure a lot of things.
genetics
Yeah.
and.
I like to think of like, a good art is polysemic. People should be able to derive their own meanings from it, and it should be able to provoke and invoke a lot of senses of like people putting their own shit into it. So, there certainly was that. There was an experimental gene therapy that, was a hot topic of conversation during the time of writing this album. There was also this idea that this sort of like a merging with machine, this idea that as we get into like an ever increasing technological world, and this idea of AI forming, and this idea of neural links, and this idea, if you see the DNA, it's starting and it's turning into these like silver, sort of almost like technological snakes, where it is sort of feeding more off our reptilian energy. It's forcing us to sort of dehumanize a little bit. It's denaturing us. We are all living online. We're all living in this sort of cyberspace. And like the idea that at its core, like there was always this concept in my head of like the denaturing of man, like while writing this record. Because I was like out in nature writing an industrial record. So it became like a sort of ever increasing sort of awareness to me where it's like, I'm out there just observing pure raw nature and then going in the studio and like writing these like very slick, polished, sort of industrialized song. So like there was that contrast for me. So yeah, I don't think there was any very specific literal meaning to any of this. It just seemed like a really strong image to play off of, I think, a lot of the concepts that were baked into this album.
So what are your feelings towards AI then? Like AI within music and the music industry and AI in general? Because there's been like huge leaps forward in AI, even in just the last few years. You've
Well,
had
the
like,
AI create music, the Nirvana stuff,
yeah,
and
and like Midjourney and all. Which I know you've kind of dabbled with a little
I
bit.
fuck with all. I fuck with all of it, to be honest. But do I think it's gonna end well? No, it can't end well. But I think that there's a sort of strange irony, and I forget who was talking about it, where it's like AI seems to be like taking the artist jobs, where like we could be using it to be like replacing like bean counter bullshit jobs. It's literally taking the Maslow's hierarchy of needs jobs, where it's like the self-actualization. It's like it's making works of art now. And it's like that's just funny to me. But I do think that in the long run, I think that AI will become so advanced that it's really going to cause a lot of problems for us. And I think that that's sort of the funny thing. The irony, maybe not funny, because it's not funny, but the irony of like capitalism becoming so self-consumptive through AI and automation that like capitalism ends up destroying itself. Where it's like, capitalism and capital accelerates technology to the point where it's like, oh, well, we won't have to pay Uber drivers if we can make the car self-drive. And then like then Uber can make zillions of dollars because there's no Uber driver making a percentage of it. And it's like, well, what if we just replace all the grocery cashiers at our grocery store, which is like AI robots and stuff like you already see with self-checkout, even though that sucks. But like, okay, what if we just replace this? That way we don't have to pay anyone to do anything because that's always where these companies like take a biggest hit on their bottom line is like paying humans to do stuff. And humans are messy creatures that you have to deal with HR and you have to pay another department. But the minute we just like, use all of this to replace all of our jobs, what the fuck do humans do? We end up in a sort of post-work society, in which case, what are we going to have to do? Make some sort of universal basic wage? Because at the end of the day, whether or not we have a million robots in the Coca-Cola factory and there's no humans working anymore, someone still has to buy the Coca-Cola in order for that factory to stay open. So ultimately, people will still have to have money to buy the Coca-Cola. So what are we going to do? We're just going to have to pay out universal basic wages for watching an hour of ads a day or something like that. Like, when you play a video game and it's like, you can get more credits. It's like a free video game, but they're like, oh, if you like Yeah, do you get credits? Like that's what the future is going to be, where it's
Pretty
like
fair one.
you watch an hour of ads a day, where you're going to get your universal basic wage that like then you can go out and buy all the fucking shit that like at least you're going to have this super division of classes where it's like that's no longer the same thing of capitalism. That's like sort of this weird sort of like, oh, you get a unit, everyone gets a universal basic wage for watching advertisement, which is a pretty fucking bleak thing. Do you know what I mean? Like that's about as fucking dark as it gets.
Yeah, living in a pod, eating bugs, watching
Yes.
avocados. It's
Yes,
basically like an
exactly.
episode of Black Mirror.
Yes, 100%. So I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but it could happen.
Well, obviously, when you're out in the desert and you were recording your new album, you teamed up with Mick Gordon, who'd done the Doom soundtracks. What was strange is that, well, probably not that strange, but during that time, we were both playing
Boom.
Doom Eternal. And whilst playing it, I was like, man, it sounds like Free Team. And
Yeah.
I was thinking to myself, if there's another Doom coming out, I've got to try and get on this or something. It was really in my mind. And then when I found out that you two were working together, I was like, oh my God, this is such a perfect fit. Three Teeth were in my mind the whole time I was playing that game.
Yeah, that was a bit of a piece of COVID serendipity, actually. So I mentioned that we were on tour in Europe in February of 2020, like as COVID was breaking out, and the Milan show was canceled. So we took a day off in Frankfurt. And in Frankfurt is where Bethesda headquarters is in Europe. And I knew the gaming, the community manager over there, and she invited us over to come, you know, play the new Doom as it was coming out. And so we're all just hanging out there and playing Doom, like thinking like, oh yeah, it sucks for Milan. And like meanwhile, they're all like dying of COVID. And like, well, I'm like, dude, the soundtrack is so sick. Like, wouldn't it be cool if we did? She's like, I'll give you his email. And so she gave me Mick Gordon's email. And I didn't really think of it. I just like back pocketed it like on the fucking notepad on my phone. And then like fast forward to like, you know, the world falling apart. And like one night we were all out in the desert in our house, like working on tunes and like drinking some whiskey, making some steaks. And like we were referencing one of his songs, being like, oh, that's so fucking sick. And I was like, oh, I have his email. Should I just email him? And everyone was like, why not? Just like shit, go for it. So I emailed him like out of nowhere, and he responded immediately. He was like, "No way, so cool to see your name in my inbox. I'm a huge fan. Would love to do something with you." So you know, that's like a go shoot your shot moment. You know, you never know. They can only say no or ignore. But yeah, he decided that he wanted to work on some stuff with us, and it was all non-local. It was all like just like through Zoom and stuff like that, because he was in lockdown in Australia in Brisbane. But yeah, it was fun. And he's a very interesting guy, Mick Gordon. Wildly talented individual, really, really creative and super, super technical brain, you know.
Yeah. So
So
for us to round things up, like what's next for you guys? What have we got to look forward to? Another record, a tour, I guess.
I honestly have no fucking clue. I mean, we just played that big sold out show in LA, and like we hadn't really played in a while, and that felt amazing. Like that felt like a return to form for us. And I don't know. I really don't know. Like, do I want to go back and write a record? Do I want to go out and tour a ton? I really don't know right now. And like, you know, it's becoming increasingly hard to make a career out of it. And I don't mean to be discouraging to anyone, because I think everyone should go chase their fucking dreams. But like, you know, as a band that like, you know, I'm on the cover of like Revolver magazine last fall, and like we got a record out on a major label. And it's like, yo, it's hard to still make money off this thing. Unless you're touring like a fucking, you know, a hamster on a wheel, you can make money that way. It's a grind. Do I want to go out and do that? I turned 40 during the pandemic. I had a little bit of like, man, I don't want to go live like that and be on tour like that. It takes its toll on your body. You know, everyone just becomes vicious alcoholics. It's just hard to do it. You know what I mean? So, you know, I think maybe less shows, but more big shows. We're certainly doing festivals. We've got some festivals coming up and stuff like
Nice.
that.
You think you'll be coming to the UK again?
I would like to. I love playing in the UK. In the UK, it was always a great, great audience for us. For me, it's always like we get a festival booking and then we can play some shows around.
Okay. So what do you think is going to happen? Like, 'cause it's a big year in America with the elections and there's like a load of movies out at the moment. Leave the World Behind, this Civil War movie that's coming out. It's like, what is in store for America, do you think, in
I
the
think America
next
is going to
year?
really be brought to the brink of its sanity this year with this election, mainly because people realize, okay, like, I mean, Joe Biden is I wouldn't get, if that guy pulled up to my house driving an Uber, I wouldn't get in. Do you know what I mean? Like the idea that like I wouldn't feel safe if him driving a car. Why am I going to let him drive the country? That's insane. And then what's the other option? You know, Donald Trump, which, you know, I'm not a Donald Trump fan. I don't like the guy. I fucking can't stand him. I think he's a blowhard. I think that the you know, in terms of some of his policy, not the worst, but I think in terms of a symbolic leader, and I do think the president of the United States is a symbolic position, I think he's atrocious as a symbolic leader for the world and for this country. You know, I just want a president that doesn't say weird shit. Like, that's all at this point. Like, can we have a guy who just doesn't, like, who can actually like speak, is like a gifted orator and like, you know, is not trying to take my guns? Like, no, you're never going to get that anymore. So I think that what the position of the presidency has been changed and it will never go back. And I don't think that qualified people want that job. You know, the people who are qualified to do it are probably just going to go be the CEO in Silicon Valley and get paid $1 trillion and not have a fucking camera shoved in their asshole like you would as the president. So, you know, I think it's like it's just a bad look all around. And I'm not sure what happens, but I don't think it's going to be good.
You got the lesser choice of two evils. One's got
Pretty
baby,
much.
one's like got baby's hair, one sniffs baby's hair.
Yeah,
Like, so
exactly.
what are you gonna do?
It's pretty fucking bleak
Biden 24.
between both of our countries. We're in some pretty fucked up situations, but I think the whole world's in a fucked up situation. The good news is people are not politics, people are not their governments. I think people are still pretty fucking cool, and at their core, people can really be helpful to each other, and we can be, you know, reasonable and kind to each other, and we should be. And I think that's a really important reminder and distinction. People are not politics. People are people first. So let's not fucking get too caught up in our own ideas.
Boom. Well said.
All right, dude. Thank you so much, Lex. It's wicked to see you again, man.
Likewise, man. I hope we can cross paths soon.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of The Schism. We've got plenty more episodes on the way. In the meantime, follow us on our Instagram at schism.tv and keep watching the skies.